Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage takes the frustrations out of getting a mortgage by letting you safely share your financial information with the touch of a button. Get approved online in minutes at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Last week, a federal appeals court struck down North Carolina's 2013 voting law. The court said the law's voter ID requirements, reduction in early voting opportunities, and changes in registration procedures were discriminatory against black voters. One judge wrote, quote, "The new provisions target African Americans with almost surgical precision." And North Carolina is not the only state where similar laws are being repealed. In the last few weeks, Kansas, North Dakota, Texas, and Wisconsin have all seen their restrictive voting laws at least partially overturned in the courts. This hour, On Point, voting rights, voting laws, and their implications for the 2016 election. You can join us on air or online. Are the courts correct to roll back these voter access laws? Are you concerned about voter fraud? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining us now from Birmingham, Alabama, is Kareem Creighton, a law professor at Vanderbilt University. He's also founder and managing partner at CrimCard Consulting Services, which offers guidance worldwide on voting and election design. Kareem Creighton, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So there has been such a flurry of these decisions in recent weeks that I don't want to overwhelm people by going through all of them, but I think it is important to go through a few of the key ones. And probably most noteworthy is North Carolina, which its law, enacted in the past few years, has been considered basically the largest rollback of the voting rights since the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And the North Carolina court that ruled on this was very strong in its language, saying that it considered this racially discriminatory. Run through with us what that law did.
Well, this statute was passed in 2013, shortly after the United States Supreme Court adopted a decision that essentially rolled back provisions of the Voting Rights Act, which had a number of anti-discrimination protections that required states to get federal permission before enacting new laws like the one that was at issue here. In the absence of that federal review, North Carolina adopted what was called by them, in fact, an omnibus piece of legislation that rolled back several provisions that made life a lot easier for voters to engage in the political process. So it did things like invoke a voter ID rule, which was by most standards one of the more stringent in the nation, requiring you to get a particular kind of ID that was that included your photo. Driver's licenses were included, but things like university license or university identifications were not. So that was required to vote at the polls. They got rid of same-day registration, something that a lot of people who didn't really have much engagement in the political process utilized. They also rolled back early voting, not entirely, but they cut out days like Sunday, which by most accounts, African Americans utilized in a program called Souls to Polls.
And this is a program where some black churches would help transport worshipers to voting sites?
Correct, correct. And it had been used to some great effect in the 2004 election, where Barack Obama won North Carolina by fewer than, I think it was probably 2 or 3 percentage points. And then finally, another significant element of it was the provision that no longer permitted a voter to show up at the polls, and even if they were in the wrong precinct, but perhaps the right district, to have their votes counted. So there was a demand now that you show up at the right precinct in order to cast your ballot.
And previously, if you made a mistake, you could vote and they would transfer it over to the right place.
Correct. And that was especially troublesome because just in 2012, the legislature had adopted a rather remarkable redistricting plan that in many cases split precincts. So you may or may not have been voting in the same place for, say, 10 or 20 years, or some people for all of their lives, who all of a sudden were moved to a new precinct. And so if you happened to show up at the same place you always did, and the lines had changed, even though you had not moved, the rule now, after the law had been adopted, required you to basically move to another place or not have your vote counted at all.
Kareem Creighton, you mentioned that in North Carolina, some IDs were allowed, but I think you mentioned that student IDs were not one of the allowed IDs?
That's correct. In fact, gun licenses were permitted under this statute to qualify for the voter ID rule. But yes, an ID issued from the state of North Carolina, University of North Carolina, for example, universities in the system would not count, according to the state, because they didn't have all of the required information about your expiration date and the like, and you couldn't be sure whether you lived in the location where the school was or where you were from. It's not quite clear that the gun licenses did the same kind of work, but they were permitted, whereas university IDs were not.
There has been some argument made by voter advocacy groups who disagreed with these laws that the laws were being designed selectively so that certain IDs who might be held by Democrats, like say you had a state-sponsored public assistance card, would not be allowed. Is that possibly a case of this, where the assumption might be if you're a student, you might be voting Democratic, and if you have a gun license, you might be voting Republican? Is there an allegation that there was sort of that level of insidious deciding which ID could be used?
There was not just allegation. There was, in fact, some evidence of that. There were definitely people who provided testimony to the state legislature that showed that there were these differences, and the court seemed to offer not only information about the partisan differences and who had certain IDs and who didn't, or who utilized certain avenues for voting and who didn't, but also, in addition to the ideological differences, racial differences. And that's what really triggered a lot of the court's analysis in trying to intuit what the intent of the legislature was in adopting the statute.
The North Carolina court, the judge that weighed in on this, said basically that it couldn't be more clear that this was a law designed to target African Americans. Now, some people disagree with that. How clear do you consider it?
This is one of those cases where the traditional cases involving intent usually have no doubt as to what the intent was, because it's either stated in the statute or the legislature comes out and full throat says, you know, this is what we intend to do, right? Those are your old school discrimination cases. We don't like group X, and therefore we're going to legislate against them. This certainly is not that explicit, but of course in the modern age, that rarely is the case. What you find instead is a circumstantial, and I think a very strong circumstantial case that takes all of this into account, that shows first the timing with which this was adopted shortly after the removal of the preclearance provision of the Voting Rights Act in Shelby County versus Holder. But in addition to that, this very close symmetry between the kinds of avenues that, again, disproportionately African Americans use, and for that matter, other groups that tend to vote Democratic, and the kinds of restrictions that were selectively enforced. The surgical precision that you referred to earlier is really a lot of this evidence that certain things were that were similar to, let's say, the voter IDs that were restricted were permitted. And there was no clear rationale for why one group was permitted and one group wasn't. And really what the court said was, look, we can't dismiss the very strong assumption that race was driving this decision. And to the extent that you did it because party was a consideration, that, you know, African Americans voted for Democrats and other people who had the ideas that you favored didn't, that won't save an otherwise impermissible consideration. And I think that's the court's rationale behind it.
Kareem Creighton, let's hear a pair of pieces of sound that show the pros and cons of this, arguments being made in North Carolina. First, we're going to hear Democratic North Carolina State Senator Floyd McKissick, who fought against the restrictive voting laws in his state. And he called into CBS on Friday and said he was grateful that the court had overturned that 2013 voter law.
It never should have been passed from the beginning. It was purposeful when they passed it. We shouldn't have had to waste the time, shouldn't have had to waste the money. It restricted voters' access to the ballot, and that's the wrong thing to do in this state.
Now, North Carolina Republican State Senate Leader Phil Berger feels differently. He told CBS News last week that the point of ID laws is to prevent voter fraud.
The important thing is enhancing confidence in elections. This is something that is about making sure that when people show up to vote, they are who they say they are.
So people continue to be in conflict about how they feel about these laws and their purpose. That's North Carolina, obviously a key swing state. Another place where a voting law was recently knocked down was Texas. This is a appeals court that voted on it, which is traditionally more conservative than the one in North Carolina is viewed. So it was very significant that even a conservative court would rule that way. Tell us what Texas did.
Well, Texas is a slightly different case insofar as the argument that the plaintiffs made against the legislative enactment, which also tried to restrict voting based on ID laws and the like, made the claim that the effect of the statute really unfairly burdened Latino voters and other people of color compared to everyone else. So this was sort of more of an effects-based rationale. And the court tended to agree because the evidence was pretty significant that even with the workarounds, most of the laws offer you a way to get access to free ID in some cases if you don't have, say, the automatic driver's license that automatically entitles you to cast a ballot. The court said, look, these rationales don't make a lot of sense given the great number of people, disproportionately Latino, who wouldn't be able to get access to the ballot or would have to go through a series of efforts to get the state-recognized alternative ID. And so the court said that under the effects rationale, we don't think that the state has done enough to limit the burdens on Latinos as compared to other groups. And that, of course, found its way up to the United States Supreme Court, back to the appeals court. And the appeals court tended to agree with the district court below that, yeah, the ultimate effect of this statute unfairly burdened Latinos as compared to other groups.
Now, in the Texas case, on the other hand, there was a dissenting judge. She had a pretty blistering response. Part of that said that there are unsupportable charges of racist motivation. So here we have very strong pushback as well to that law being weakened.
Right. And this is, you know, a current of argument that you see in a lot of cases. And certainly when it got to the Supreme Court the first time, there was some concern that the argument against these statutes tends to undermine or undervalue the extent to which states have some discretion to adopt rules to run the election system. And I think the dissenting judge in this case and on the Fifth Circuit tended to say, look, you know, you can't just sort of assume that there were unfriendly motives just because the outcome tends to make life a little bit more challenging for some groups than the other, absent something much more stark, like, again, the animus-based statement by a legislature saying, we don't like you people. This was certainly not that case per se, and therefore many of the dissenters, like this judge on the Fifth Circuit, would say we should give the state the room to legislate. Otherwise, we, the courts, are finding ourselves immersed in the political game, and we shouldn't be engaged in that particular manner.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with Vanderbilt University Law Professor Kareem Creighton. He's also managing partner at CrimCard Consulting Services, which assists communities worldwide on voting and election design. Join this conversation. We want to know at your polling place if you have to show an ID. If not, do you think you should? Do you think early voting should be allowed? And if so, how early, for how long? What about same-day registration? Kareem Creighton, stand by, because joining us from New York is Ari Berman. He's a writer for The Nation magazine and the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, which is out in paperback this week. Ari Berman, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Sasha. Good to be here.
And also with us from New York is John Fund, a columnist for the National Review. He's also co-author of Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk. John Fund, welcome to you too, to On Point.
Thank you. Pleasure, Sasha.
So as we were just talking about a string of court decisions recently that knocked down voter laws that had some people believe are restrictive to voting, and this, for many people, shows that judges are lending weight to the Democratic view, largely, that these laws have been about voter suppression. We talked about North Carolina and Texas before the break. There have also been rulings in Wisconsin, in North Dakota, in Kansas, Ohio, Michigan. Could you, Ari Berman, give us a little sense of the history here? Because it's important to go back to 1965 and remind us what the Voting Rights Act did and why it went into place. Tell us about that law.
Yes, absolutely, Sasha. So the Voting Rights Act is really the most important civil rights law of the 20th century, and it did a few remarkable things. Before the passage of the Voting Rights Act, many voters of color were disenfranchised in the Jim Crow South. In Mississippi, for example, only 6.7% of African Americans were registered to vote. In Selma, Alabama, where the Bloody Sunday March took place, only 2% of African Americans were registered to vote. And the Voting Rights Act got rid of those suppressive devices, like literacy tests and poll taxes, that had prevented African Americans from being able to vote for so many years. It sent federal officials down to the South to register voters within days of the law's passage, which led to a remarkable increase in the number of voters registered. And it said to those states with the longest histories of discrimination, largely in the South but not exclusively, that they had to approve their voting changes with the federal government to prevent discrimination in the future. That one part of the law, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, blocked 3,000 discriminatory voting changes from 1965 until 2013, when the Supreme Court ruled that those states with that long history of discrimination, like North Carolina and Texas that you mentioned earlier, no longer had to approve their voting changes with the federal government.
So again, if they wanted to make any change to how their voting laws worked in their states, a federal court or the Department of Justice had to step in, look at it, make sure the change wasn't meant to restrict minorities from voting, and then possibly okay it or not okay it.
Yeah, and this was remarkable because it put the burden of proof on the states that had a history of discrimination to make sure they didn't discriminate in the future. And it didn't allow them to put these changes into effect until they had been approved. And this was so important because of the history of this country, that we had a period after the Civil War where we passed the 13th, the 14th, and the 15th Amendment to give full rights to African Americans, and people voted during Reconstruction for a brief period of time. And then we saw things like poll taxes and literacy tests and grandfather clauses and property requirements that rolled Black voting rights back. And the Voting Rights Act wanted to make sure we weren't in a similar situation where people were given the right to vote, then disenfranchised, then re-enfranchised, and then disenfranchised all over again. And that's why this one part of the Voting Rights Act was so important.
Now, interestingly, the Voting Rights Act, tell me if I'm correct here, in addition to just the big southern states we tend to hear about, there are also individual counties, other municipalities, I think even Brooklyn, Manhattan, the Bronx were held to some degree to these requirements. Is that right?
Yes, there are other places that were covered because they discriminated against what was called language minority groups. So Hispanics, Asian Americans, Native Americans, that was done in 1975, and that broadened the power of the Voting Rights Act. It covered places like Texas and Arizona and parts of New York. So the Voting Rights Act is not just something that applied to the South. It was national in scope. And not only that, there was another part of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, that was national in scope, that could be used anywhere. And that's what has been used to challenge voting laws in places like North Carolina and Texas more recently. So what we're seeing is that the Voting Rights Act has been weakened by the Supreme Court's decision gutting the Voting Rights Act, but it has not been totally eliminated either.
John Fund, a columnist for the National Review, as I know we will hear from you later, you are often a believer that many of these voting rights laws that have been knocked down were reasonable in many ways. Can you tell us your view of the 1965 Voting Rights Act? Did you take issue with any of the restrictions it put in place?
I think the Voting Rights Act was a major milestone in progress for American voting rights. But what we're discussing today is things that frankly have nothing to do with the Jim Crow laws that struck down. In 2008, the Supreme Court, in an opinion written by one of the most liberal justices, John Paul Stevens, ruled that voting ID laws, quote, did not even represent a significant increase in the usual burdens of voting. So I think these recent court decisions, which go against most of the court decisions that came before this year, go against the spirit of that Supreme Court decision. And I believe that we can come to a reasonable compromise which balances two civil rights. We have the civil right to make sure that never again are people blocked from voting or prevented from voting. And we also, at the same time, have the civil right that our vote shouldn't be canceled out by someone who shouldn't be voting, isn't eligible to vote, is dead, or doesn't even exist.
John Fund, we are the phone quality we have with you is quite crackling. I'm not sure if you can hear it. We are going to see if our producer can call you back to improve that phone line. So I'm going to go back to Ari Berman, and hopefully we'll be back with you within about a minute. Ari Berman, writer at The Nation. Tell us, in terms of the rulings that we've seen in recent weeks, we heard, for example, many of these new laws that were struck down were enacted after the Supreme Court ruled in 2013 that it was going to knock down parts of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. So basically, we heard from Chief Justice John Roberts in 2013 that history has moved on, that some of the requirements of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 are no longer necessary in this day and age. Tell us about that argument.
Well, John Roberts said that history had changed since 1965, that the country had made a tremendous amount of progress, but that the Voting Rights Act continued to treat the nation as if it was stuck in 1965. I think what the Chief Justice did not recognize in his opinion was that voter suppression didn't end in 1965 either. And indeed, what has happened after the gutting of the Voting Rights Act was the best argument for the power of the Voting Rights Act, because laws that were blocked as discriminatory, like Texas's voter ID law, where you can vote with a gun permit but not a student ID, those were allowed to go into effect. The North Carolina, as you mentioned earlier, passed more sweeping voting restrictions. And the opinion in North Carolina, where the court said that black voters were targeted with almost surgical precision, was a remarkable rebuke to John Roberts' claim that voting discrimination was largely a thing of the past. And what's been so interesting about the last 2 weeks, when Republican-backed voting restrictions have been struck down in six states in a matter of 2 weeks, is that this was done by both courts that were conservative and courts that were more liberal. So there were George W. Bush-appointed judges that struck down voting restrictions in places like Texas and North Dakota. And then there were Obama and Bill Clinton appointed judges that struck down laws in places like North Carolina. So there is almost an increasing bipartisan consensus on the courts that these voting restrictions have gone too far, that they violate both the spirit and the actual wording of the Voting Rights Act, and that voting discrimination is not a thing of the past, and that unfortunately voter suppression efforts are still ongoing in the year 2016.
Let's go to a caller. This is Steve calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for taking my call, Sasha. 2 points. Number one, ever since Joe Kennedy was supposed to have manipulated the election of his son, particularly in Illinois, there have been a lot of concerns about voter fraud. Correct or incorrect, a lot of people have lost confidence. And then again, you have Acorn, the insinuations against Acorn. Right or wrong, a lot of people are concerned that there is fraud going on. So that is a problem that needs to be addressed. The second point I make, and the last point, is that here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to get food from a food pantry, to enter the Senior Citizen Center, to get fuel assistance or food stamps, you need a photo ID. So I don't see how opponents of these voter ID can say with a straight face, this puts an undue burden on poor people.
Steve, thank you for that call. And I believe that we have John Fund, columnist for the National Review, back with us on a better line. John, are you there?
Yes, thank you.
Great. So we just heard caller Steve from Cambridge talking about his belief that it is not unreasonable to ask for an ID at the polls. That's an opinion you share. Tell us about that.
Well, there's almost nothing you can do in life without having an ID. You can't get any kind of government benefit. In many cases, you can't even travel, and you can't enter federal buildings without an ID. I understand from your producer that you can't even enter your office there in Boston University without an ID. So I believe that we can come to a reasonable compromise. 2 years ago, Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, Andrew Young, the former mayor of Atlanta, and Martin Luther King III all came together and said, all right, if some people don't trust the states to implement voter ID laws fairly, let's take the Social Security card that almost every American has, put a photo ID on it, and allow that to be used for purposes of voting. It would cost 10 cents. And they said this would be also a way of making sure that for the few people who lack an ID, they can participate in the mainstream of American life. Andrew Young, who was a confidant of Martin Luther King, called it could be a freedom card, because we want to make people participate in our society, participate in voting. If they don't have an ID, let's get them one.
John Fund, the Republican Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker shares your view, and in May he defended the state's voter ID law. Let's hear what he had to say.
People can either vote with things like their driver's license or other forms, or if they need to, there's no barrier out there. They can get a Wisconsin identification card for free, and we've added additional ways for them to do that.
Again, that was Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. Now let's hear from someone else from Wisconsin. This is Alfonso Noble. He's an adopted black teenager. He talked to MSNBC in April about not having a driver's license and how that was frustrating to him.
I knew from the jump I was going to need an ID, but I didn't think I had to, I didn't think it would be like so hard for me to actually get my ID.
John Fund, how easy or not easy do you think society makes it now for people to have the proper identification required for states that have voter ID requirements?
Well, let's take Wisconsin, which had its voter ID in place until a couple weeks ago. In Wisconsin, if you go to the polls and you have just started the process of applying for an ID, you don't even actually have one, you've just filled out the form to get one, you're still allowed to vote. And in all of these states that we're talking about, the ID is free. I think what Alfonso in the clip was talking about was getting a driver's license. But the process for getting a state identification card is very, very simple. You just have to prove you are who you say you are, and you will be given a free ID. And if you don't have that free ID, I really wonder how in the world you get around in life every day.
Let's hear from another caller. This is Mary calling from Northborough, Massachusetts. Mary, welcome to On Point.
Yes, thank you very much. And I think this is a very interesting conversation. I am with you completely on that everyone should have to have some kind of a photo ID.
To vote at the polls, you think they should need a photo ID?
Absolutely. I'm appalled when I go to my polls and they ask me my address and they cross my name off and they don't even ask me to prove that that's my address. I think it's ridiculous. And I think the photo ID is one way of making sure that Americans are voting for our American government and our American way of life.
Do you actually think there's a discriminatory aspect to being asked for an ID?
I don't. That's my problem. I don't understand why people would be upset about having to give an ID. I don't know what they're trying to hide, and I agree with your guest that I don't know how they're getting along in life if they don't have some kind of a photo ID. It makes me feel when they say that it's discriminatory to ask for a photo ID, it makes me feel that they have something to hide.
Mary, thanks for that. Ari Berman, would you please weigh in on that? So Ari is a writer at The Nation. What do you think?
So a few quick points. First off, voting is a fundamental right. It's not like buying liquor or flying on a plane. The second thing is that voter impersonation, which these voter ID laws are meant to address, are exceedingly rare. There have only been 31 cases of voter impersonation since 2000 out of a billion votes cast. In comparison, there are 300 deaths by lightning a year. So you're 10 times more likely to be struck by lightning than you are to impersonate another voter at the polls. Third thing is, these laws aren't just asking for ID, they're asking for strict forms of ID. So they're excluding forms of ID like student ID, public employee IDs that you can use for lots of different aspects in life. The fourth thing is that it's not just liberals that are making the argument against these laws now. It was a George W. Bush appointed judge that said that Texas's voter ID law discriminated against Black and Hispanic voters. So conservative judges are saying this as well. And we know in states like Texas, hundreds of thousands of voters, 5% of the electorate, don't have strict forms of ID. And it's not just that they don't have them, it's that many people are having trouble getting access to them. To get quote-unquote free forms of ID, you often need underlying documents like a birth certificate. Well, if you were born at home in the segregated South to a midwife, like elderly voters were in Texas, you never had a birth certificate. So then you're caught in a crazy catch-22 where you can't get the ID that you need to vote because you can't get the underlying documents you need to produce that ID. So there are lots of burdens associated with these laws. I know it's a very good talking point to be able to say everyone should have ID, but as courts are showing in Texas, in North Carolina, in North Dakota, these laws are discriminating against Blacks and Hispanics and Native Americans, and that's why they're being struck down. It's not a hypothetical question anymore. There is real evidence that these laws are disenfranchising voters.
John Fund?
Evidence. Well, evidence needs to be put before courts, and in Texas and North Carolina, the plaintiffs never gave the names of anyone who had been prevented from voting. And so if such people exist, they weren't able to be found. And as for the fundamental constitutional right, you know, we had a big Supreme Court argument last year about gay marriage. Well, in all 50 states, if you're getting married, gay or otherwise, you have to show ID. That's a fundamental constitutional right, I think.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century. Forget about digging through stacks of paperwork. This completely online process lets you safely share your bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button. Using a phone or tablet, you can get approved for purchase or refinance in just a few minutes. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with Kareem Creighton, Vanderbilt University law professor, Ari Berman, writer for The Nation magazine, and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, and John Fund, co-author of Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk. You can join the conversation. As you go to the polls this November, do you have faith in the integrity of our democratic process, and why or why not? Do you think that requiring photo IDs, for example, is wise or malicious? And before the break, we were talking about this issue of voter fraud. How prevalent is it? Is it not very prevalent? I want to read two comments that have come in on our website. One is from someone with the screen name Honest Debate 2. It says, "It's impossible to measure voter fraud. All one needs is a name, and there is absolutely no trace to be found. But why is it necessary to prove voter fraud before we protect a system that is so vulnerable? And believe it or not, blacks are just as capable as getting a valid ID as whites. It's so condescending to insist otherwise." Here's one more. This is PI Mac screen name. "When people assert there is no evidence of voter fraud, I ask, please cite the research that has been done." So, Ari Berman, would you take this one? Tell us about what research you know of that weighs in on the issue of whether there is voter fraud or whether voting fraud is a myth.
There have been extensive studies about this that show that voter impersonation is exceedingly rare. The study that I mentioned earlier that showed that only there have been only 31 cases of voter impersonation since 2000 out of a billion votes cast was conducted by Justin Levitt, a law professor at Loyola University who's now head of the voting section at the Justice Department, so someone with a lot of credibility. There's also been a lot of evidence brought before these states in places like North Carolina, in Texas, in Wisconsin. And what the judge wrote in Wisconsin recently, and I just want to read you a brief excerpt of this opinion because I think it really gets to the heart of the matter. He said, Judge James Peterson said, "The Wisconsin experience demonstrates that a preoccupation with mostly phantom election fraud leads to real incidents of disenfranchisement, which undermine rather than enhance confidence in elections, particularly in minority communities." One other thing, which is that courts in Texas and in North Carolina made a similar point, which is that these voter ID laws, in fact, will lead to more election fraud. And the reason this will happen is because they require IDs for in-person voting, where fraud is exceedingly rare, but they exempt IDs in North Carolina from absentee voting, where fraud is more common. And the reason that this happens is because voters of color and Democratic voters are more likely to vote in person, whereas white voters and Republican voters are more likely to vote absentee. So what the court said in North Carolina is under the guise of, quote unquote, stopping voter fraud, North Carolina has actually made fraud paradoxically more common by not requiring it for absentee ballots where the small amount of voter fraud in the system actually occurs.
Now, Kareem Creighton of Vanderbilt Law School, on the other hand, there is some evidence of fraud in absentee voting. I understand that's where it tends to be seen. And, you know, voter IDs, which are meant to combat voter impersonation, don't particularly help with absentee ballots. So tell us about that piece of this.
Well, I think and thanks for letting me back in. There's a lot that can be addressed here. In terms of just a sort of rational way, if you're trying to rig an election system, not saying that it is, but if you're thinking about it from a rational perspective, you want to be able to affect as many votes as possible with the least amount of work. Doing it person by person is a very inefficient way of doing it, and it is one reason why there isn't actually very much evidence of that. To the extent that you're trying to sway an election, you want to bundle votes together. That would happen much more in managing absentee ballots because you never see who the people are. And as Ari suggested earlier, there isn't a great deal of regulation on that end. But I also – it's important to see two things if I can. One, as you point out, there isn't very much regulation for that. There also isn't very much regulation for a number of areas, but one in particular – we see huge amounts of evidence of fraud, and that's actually in campaign finance fraud. There's an argument that money actually influences elections far more than anyone's individual vote does, and there's not very much activity going on in legislating to restrict that kind of fraudulent activity. And that happens, by the way, for Democrats and Republicans alike. I think the debate between Ari and John kind of obscures one important point I think that's important to keep in mind. This isn't really an argument between having voter ID and not having voter ID. There are a number of nations around the world that tend to. The question is, if one is to adopt a voter ID rule, is it going to be neutrally applied so that everybody has basically the same rules that they operate under? And just to give you a sense of what I mean by that, John mentioned earlier the point about traveling with an ID. If you think about your typical airport where everybody does require an ID, there's some people who get what's called the TSA pre-check line or the global entry line. That's a pretty fast line to go through, and there are fewer hurdles that you have to go through to get through the security check. Everybody else, a large number of people, have to go through the normal line. That takes a long time depending on the airport you happen to be in. The point is, if everybody actually is supposed to have the same access and the burdens are higher for some groups versus the others, there is some concern about rules that are selective in taking friends to put them through the fast track line and enemies or people who you don't consider your friends to put them through the slow line. That's what's really at issue here. And it's the selectivity that the legislatures often are sometimes examined to be engaged in that the courts are concerned about, particularly where race is concerned.
Let's put this issue in the context of the current campaign season, the election coming up in November, because these court rulings of recent weeks are particularly pertinent because the election is so close. And this presidential election will be the first one since the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act. So let's first hear a piece of sound from President Obama. This is him speaking at South by Southwest this March, and he's expressing concerns about voting restrictions.
We're the only advanced democracy in the world that makes it harder for people to vote. You're laughing, but it's sad. We take enormous pride in the fact that we are the world's oldest continuous democracy, and yet we systematically put up barriers and make it as hard as possible for our citizens to vote.
Let's also hear from Donald Trump. He spoke in Columbus, Ohio, Monday, and he expressed his suspicions of a rigged electoral system.
First of all, it's rigged. And I'm afraid the election's going to be rigged, I have to be honest. Because I think my side was rigged. If I didn't win by massive landslides, I mean, think of what we won in New York and Indiana, California, 78%. That's with other people in the race.
And he says that part of the evidence that it's rigged, as he puts it, is that these laws requiring photo IDs at the polls have been thrown out in some cases. So, John Fund, give us your sense about how this issue factors into this campaign season.
Well, first of all, President Obama is completely wrong in saying that we're the only nation that creates any kind of responsibility in voting. Other than Great Britain, please name me an industrialized democracy that doesn't require an ID at the polls. All of them do. As for fraud, let's be very clear. In-person voter fraud at the polls is very difficult to show because it's such a perfect crime. In New York City, 63 attempts were made by the New York City Department of Investigations 2 years ago. They sent in people who were using the names of people out of state who were dead or were in prison, and they tried to vote. No, New York does not have an ID law. In 61 of the 63 times, they succeeded. And I interviewed the head of the investigation team there, and they said there is no way to show how much in-person voter fraud there is, because once you fill out the ballot without showing ID and you throw it in the pile with all the other ballots, there's no evidence that you'll ever find that there was a fraudulent vote cast. So I think that this is a deterrent to behavior that indeed can happen, may be happening, and we don't know if to what extent it's happening.
Let's bring in a caller. This is Georgia from Canton, Ohio. Georgia, welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. Couple things. I think it's impossible to talk about voter election disenfranchisement and fraud and ignore what happened during the Democratic primary. We experienced and saw voter purging. Talk about disenfranchisement, man. Polling locations being reduced, sometimes three-fourths less polling locations, extremely long lines. We had a massive amount of new voter registration, and there was people's affiliations being switched. I'm curious as to, you know, I hate to sound cynical, but a lot of us have been dealing with this issue for months now, and now that that Democratic primary is over and we're into the general election, it seems to be a topic of conversation. I'm just curious as to what your take on the recent events are.
Ari, do you want to take that one?
Sure. So there were a lot of problems in the primaries, which both were a result of new laws, new restrictions put in place, bureaucratic incompetence, lots of different things. As the caller mentioned, there was a major voter purging in Brooklyn, in Maricopa County, Arizona. 70% of polling places were closed, which led to very long lines. There were people who were turned away from the polls by new restrictions in places like North Carolina. And this is not something that I just started paying attention to. I've been covering this issue since 2011. I wrote an entire book about the history of the Voting Rights Act, because I believe that these are very important issues to cover, not just 3 months before the election. And so I think that this should, all of this evidence that we're seeing, whether it's court decisions striking down these laws or it's problems in the primary, should lead to a conversation of how we can make the electoral system better. How can we get more people to participate in American elections? How can we make sure people's votes are counted? How can we make sure that people have confidence in the election? And in my view, the way to do that is not to pass new laws that make it harder to vote, which disenfranchise people, but try to figure out a way how to get more people to participate while also making elections more secure. And I think we can do that, but I think it takes the political will to start addressing solutions as opposed to trying to address phantom problems like voter impersonation, which don't really exist.
Let's take another caller. This is Camille from New Berlin, Wisconsin. Camille, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I work the polls. The last election, I had to turn away people who did not have their photo ID. They said they'd come back. They never did. Ran out of time. When Scott Walker was recalled, the election that was held had a record turnout. It was 54%. Some elections, we have 19 to 20% turnout. We don't need restrictive laws. We need to get more people to the polls, not less.
Well, that's, I think that's a really important point to make, which is we tend in this country to have such pitiful, really, voter turnout that we need to find reasonable ways to bring people to the polls without there also being restrictions built in intentionally or unintentionally. Kareem Creighton, can you tell us whether you feel that there is, what is the best solution? How can we do this?
Well, the truth of the matter is there are a lot of different ways to skin this cat. And frankly, John suggested it earlier, worldwide, a number of countries have taken a variety of approaches at trying to address the problem. And John is correct. A number of states, that is nations outside of the United States, use elements like voter ID. However, what's important to see is that in these other countries, everyone gets the same ID. So it's the same process that's open to everyone. In this country, and I guess I need to give a shout out to people like your last caller who are poll workers, the administrators for elections, many of these people, in fact, I'd say most of these people work extra hard to try to get this right. And I want to make sure that we emphasize there are many, the sum total of the people who do this kind of work are in it because they really believe that the right to vote is fundamental and they want to do the job well. But I think as pointed out, there's a real problem here when you have a kind of slipshod change in laws, either due to legislative enactments or court decisions that make it difficult to do the job well. How do we encourage it? I think we do find new and interesting ways of pulling people into the process and making it easier to cast ballots. And frankly, we do need to have a process that allows people who administer elections. The biggest gripe you hear from most people who do this kind of work is, look, we sometimes don't have the resources and we don't have the time to build the kind of infrastructure necessary to bring people in. We are operating in some ways a kind of patchwork system where we have really a digitized world and a lot of other ways in which people interface with government. And so finding new and innovative ways to make that happen is one part of the challenge, which is technological. The other part of the challenge, though, is, and this is, I think, partly why this debate about voter ID is so difficult, anytime you adopt a reform, people are looking at it through a partisan lens because they want to know whether my side is going to benefit or the other side is going to be disadvantaged. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's so crucial that when you adopt these new changes, that you try to do it in ways that are neutral, that applies the same rule to everyone. And I think the courts in North Carolina and Texas have observed that even though in theory voter ID is not objectionable per se, the way in which it was implemented, the kinds of information that the legislature took in, and also the way in which it was applied without attention to the effects on different populations raises a lot of concerns. And we have a particular history with respect to race that we can't simply ignore when we think about how those reforms are enacted.
John Fund, I want to hear from you before we end the hour. You've said that rather than knock down these laws, why don't we work to ensure that everyone can easily obtain an ID? On the other hand, we have heard courts say it seems clear to us that some of these laws were enacted to discriminate against minorities. So do you think that we need the laws back? And if so, how do we make sure they are not discriminatory?
Well, first of all, the laws in those states have been operating without major complaint, without even minor complaint for several elections. So the evidence isn't there. And I would like to ask Ari and Kareem, what is wrong with Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter and Andrew Young and Martin Luther King III's idea that if you want to treat people alike, let's expand the ID to include a federal Social Security card with a photo ID on it at a cost of 10 cents per card, and that would take care of a lot of this debate. Unfortunately, Al Sharpton and other people who I think have less than pure motives shot that idea down, and they told the Obama Justice Department, we don't want anything to do with that. What is wrong with the idea of Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton and Andrew Young and Martin Luther King III? What is wrong with their idea?
And unfortunately, we're going to have to leave those questions hanging. It's a good debate, but we've ended the hour. Maybe we'll continue the debate later. Thanks very much to all three of you. We were talking with Vanderbilt University Law Professor Kareem Creighton, founder and managing partner at CrimCard Consulting Services, which offers guidance on voting and election design. Ari Berman, reporter for The Nation magazine and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And John Fund, co-author of Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk, and a columnist at the National Review. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, President Obama makes another strong push for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, putting himself at odds with Clinton, with Trump, and maybe also with you. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.